imagine your life is just entirely falling apart, like totally shattering.
Right. The foundation is just gone.
Yeah. Your spouse has discovered this massive betrayal. They're confronting you with the physical proof, like a note or something.
The air is thick with grief.
Oh, completely. And in that precise, devastating second, your face does something entirely outside of your control.
Which is the worst possible thing.
It really is. Instead of looking apologetic or, you know, breaking down in tears, your facial muscles involuntarily pull themselves into this broad, good-humored, completely idiotic smile.
It's the ultimate betrayal by your own nervous system.
Just that singular, involuntary twitch of the cheek muscles. And it doesn't just end a marriage. It kicks off what might be, well, maybe the greatest psychological thriller ever written.
Oh, for sure. It's Steve Oblonsky's reflex spinal action as he tries to rationalize it later, which basically sets fire to his household.
It initiates the sprawling tragedy of Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina.
Which is what we're looking at today.
Right. Our mission today is to act as your companion for this immense journey. If you're listening out there, we're drawing from the brilliant Clarence Horatio audiobook performance of the novel, alongside some historical critiques and letters from the 1870s.
To kind of map out the hidden tensions for you.
Yeah, the structural engineering, the razor-sharp social critiques of Tolstoy's world.
Mm.
If you're preparing to listen to this epic, or even if you're already navigating the heavy volume of Russian names and aristocratic drama, we want to provide a spoiler-friendly roadmap.
We aren't going to give you a simple summary because, I mean, you likely already know the shape of the story.
Yeah, a summary isn't helpful. Instead, we're unpacking the mechanics of why these characters make such spectacularly ruinous decisions.
And how this 19th century narrative dissects the very modern anatomy of isolation and purpose.
So to really grasp the stakes of those ruinous decisions, we first have to reconstruct the ground these characters are actually walking on.
Right, because Russia in the 1870s was a society caught in a massive, agonizing transition.
It's essentially a culture split in two.
Yeah, and Tolstoy constantly ricochets the listener between these two opposing realities.
The geographic whiplash is intense. One moment you're suffocating in these glittering, hyper-regulated ballrooms of Moscow and St. Petersburg.
Where the air is thick with expensive French perfume and, you know, political maneuvering.
And then the next, you're standing in a freezing field in the rural provinces watching peasants harvest wheat.
It's not just a change of scenery. It's a collision of entire philosophies of existence.
Yeah, Tolstoy uses these distinct environments to isolate different forms of human artifice and authenticity.
The city, Petersburg in particular, represents an existence built entirely on bureaucratic rules and optics.
It's the epicenter of the Russian Empire.
Right, where a person's worth is calculated by their rank, their social discretion, and how well they navigate scandal.
Which is the domain of Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin and his husband.
He's a high-ranking government minister whose entire nervous system seems wired to public opinion rather than personal feeling.
I always picture Karenin as a man whose blood has been completely replaced by bureaucratic ink.
That is a great way to put it.
And contrasting him, we have Konstantin Levin out in the country. Levin represents this desperate, almost muddy search for a grounded life.
He wants to know what it means to actually produce something real.
Rather than just shifting paper around a mahogany desk all day.
And that contrast brings us face to face with the severe class divides of the era. The novel is set just a decade or so after the emancipation of the Russian serfs in 1861.
So the old feudal order has collapsed.
Exactly. And landowners like Levin are struggling to figure out how to work with free peasants.
The text makes a profound point of showing us these peasants working in bast shoes, which are these cheap, fragile shoes woven directly from the bark of linden trees.
They're the ultimate symbol of rural poverty, a life tied painfully close to the earth.
Contrast those woven bark shoes with the elite military circles of Petersburg. Vronsky, the cavalry officer who upends Anna's life, he belongs to a world the text explicitly mocks as brainless beef.
I love that phrase. It's incredibly deliberate.
It really is.
It describes a micro-society of immensely wealthy, physically magnificent young officers whose primary duties involve grooming their horses, gambling away fortunes, and conducting socially sanctioned love affairs.
They consume immense resources, but produce absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
So let's look at how the Clarence Horatio audiobook brings this dense social web to life. Because maneuvering through the names alone can feel like, I don't know, learning a new language.
Well, for sure.
Yeah.
You have characters referred to by their first names, their nicknames, their patronymics.
For a listener, understanding how this naming convention works is basically the skeleton key to understanding the social dynamics in the room.
The Russian patronymic system is so crucial here. A person's middle name is derived from their father's first name.
Okay, so Karenin is Alexei Alexandrovich, Alexei son of Alexander.
Right. And Anna is Anna Arkadyevna, Anna, daughter of Arkady. What you need to listen for in the audio performance is when characters use these names.
Because it changes, right?
It does. Using the full name and patronymic is formal, it's respectful, it establishes a clear social boundary.
But when a character suddenly switches to a diminutive nickname or drops the patronymic altogether,
it signals a dramatic shift in intimacy or a deliberate breach of etiquette. The audiobook makes these shifts incredibly obvious through the narrator's tone.
It's basically the 19th century equivalent of suddenly dropping a formal title in an email and using someone's first name to show them you hold the power.
Yes, it's a linguistic weapon.
And speaking of weapons, let's chart the overarching structure of the story. Since we're assuming you listening have the basic trajectory of Anna's affair and Levin's courtship down, I want to bypass the standard plot summary.
We want to look at the actual physics of the narrative.
Yeah. The entire book is structured around two massive opposing forces.
Two parallel tracks that never truly intersect, but they constantly reflect each other. Track one is the trajectory of the fall, and track two is the trajectory of the climb.
Let's break down track one first. Anna comes to Moscow as the ultimate peacemaker. She's brought in to fix the wreckage caused by her brother Steva's involuntary idiotic smile that we talked about earlier.
She sits his devastated wife, Dolly, down, applies her immense emotional intelligence, and just puts out the fire in their marriage.
She is the emotional firefighter. But the tragedy is that she catches a spark while doing it.
She meets Count Bronski.
And the very passion she just counseled Dolly to forgive in Steva becomes the force that burns Anna's own life to ash.
Her trajectory from that moment is a relentless downward spiral. She abandons Karenin and her young son, Serioza.
She and Bronski flee to Italy.
Right. They try to live outside the rules of Russian society as independent, enlightened individuals. Mm. But the physics of their world just won't allow it.
They're pulled back to Russia, where the isolation begins to crush Anna. She descends into this suffocating paranoia that inevitably leads to the railway station.
Now, track two operates in reverse. Konstantin Levin begins the novel in a state of utter rejection.
He comes to the city, proposes to Kitty, who is Dolly's sister, and is flatly turned down.
Because Kitty believes Vronsky is going to propose to her.
But of course, Vronsky abandons Kitty the second he locks eyes with Anna. So both Levin and Kitty start the novel emotionally destroyed.
And their journey is the climb. It's the painstaking, awkward, and often frustrating process of rebuilding their lives.
They eventually find their way back to each other.
They do, but Tolstoy doesn't treat their marriage as a magical cure-all. Track two is about the daily, grinding effort required to create meaning through agriculture, family, confronting the terrifying inevitability of death.
As Anna is disintegrating, Levin is slowly, agonizingly integrating.
That's a perfect way to frame it.
Now, I have a massive point of contention here regarding track one, specifically concerning Count Vronsky.
Oh, let's hear it.
It is incredibly easy, especially with modern sensibilities, to look at Vronsky and label him the villain of the piece. I mean, he seduces a married woman, ruins an innocent girl's prospects, triggers a family's destruction.
He does all of that.
But looking closely at the text, I don't buy that he operates with malicious intent. He isn't a mustache-twirling antagonist. He is just a man executing the specific programming of his social class, isn't he?
That is a vital distinction to make, and it changes how you listen to his interactions. Vronsky is a product of a Petersburg elite that values aesthetics over ethics.
The text explicitly outlines how he categorizes the world, right?
Yes. He believes humanity is divided into two distinct classes. The first is the lower class. The vulgar, ridiculous people who actually believe in fidelity, who think husbands should live with their wives, and who worry about paying their bills.
It's almost comical how offended he is by the concept of basic morality.
To him, it is genuinely distasteful. Hmm. The second class, which he belongs to, is what he considers the real people.
And their defining characteristics are what? Being elegant, generous, bold.
And most importantly, to abandon oneself to passion without a hint of shame. When Vronsky courts Kitty, he has no intention of marriage, but he also doesn't think he's doing anything cruel. He believes he's simply playing his part in a beautiful, socially expected dance.
And when he pursues Anna, he views it as a noble aristocratic conquest. He is following the rules of his specific subculture to the letter.
Which brings us to the mechanics of the 19th century double standard. This is something modern audiences frequently misunderstand.
We tend to think of this era as universally puritanical.
Right, where any hint of adultery resulted in immediate banishment. But that's not how the high society of Petersburg operated at all. Affairs weren't the anomaly. They were an established pastime.
Tolstoy dedicates significant time to illustrating this through characters like Princess Betsy Tiverskaya.
Betsy's circle is comprised of incredibly wealthy women who routinely engage in extramarital affairs.
The crucial difference between them and Anna lies in the unwritten laws of decorum. Society didn't care who you slept with. Society cared deeply about how successfully you maintained the illusion of the institution of marriage.
It was entirely about stage management. Yes, a woman could have a lover, provided her husband played his designated role as the blind or tolerant patriarch.
The husband escorts the wife to the theater, holds her shawl, and then looks the other way when the lover rides alongside her carriage.
The mortal sin wasn't infidelity.
No, the mortal sin was making a public mess.
Anna's true crime is her demand for authenticity. She refuses to operate in the shadows.
She breaks the covenant of polite fiction by demanding that her passionate truth be recognized by a society whose entire architecture relies on secrets and lies.
And nowhere is that architecture more brilliantly exposed than in the reaction of her husband, Karenin.
I find his response to the affair to be one of the most chilling psychological portraits in literature.
It really is.
Because we expect the betrayed husband to show rage or devastation, or at least some form of recognizable human grief.
He should be throwing a chair through a window.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Instead, Karenin approaches his wife's infidelity as if he's managing a localized public relations crisis for a mid-level government department.
The way Tolstoy frames Karenin's internal monologue is terrifying in its coldness. When the reality of the affair becomes undeniable, Karenin sits in his study and literally drafts a mental memo of his options.
Like a literal checklist.
Yes. He considers challenging Vronsky to a duel. He considers initiating divorce proceedings. He considers formal separation.
And the criteria he uses to evaluate these options has absolutely nothing to do with love or morality.
He discards the idea of a duel because he realizes he might get shot, or worse, look ridiculous holding a pistol.
He rejects divorce because the legal process in 19th century Russia required a massive public airing of dirty laundry,
which would splash mud onto his pristine reputation.
He assesses the destruction of his family exactly as he assesses a report for the Commission for the Reorganization of the Native Tribes.
Or the Board of Irrigation. Two actual absurdly bureaucratic committees he runs.
He treats human trauma as a logistical error that needs to be filed away.
His ultimate solution is to force Anna to remain in his house, maintain the visual aesthetic of a functioning marriage, and forbid Vronsky from visiting.
He thinks to himself, quite literally, that he cannot be made unhappy by the fact that a contemptible woman has committed a crime.
He amputates his own emotions to save his social standing.
There is that horrific detail where he writes her a letter outlining these new living conditions, and he remembers to enclose her monthly expense allowance in the envelope.
Right.
He seals it, smooths it down with a massive ivory paper knife, and feels a genuine sense of gratification at how orderly his writing desk looks.
It's so disturbing.
His wife's soul is hemorrhaging, his family is dead, and he's just deeply satisfied with his stationery.
It perfectly encapsulates the emotional deadness of the urban bureaucracy. It's a system designed to insulate men from the messy, chaotic reality of human feeling.
Which transitions us perfectly to why Levin hates the city so much. Levin is fundamentally incapable of dealing with this type of artificiality.
There is a specific, highly relatable scene early in the book that crystallizes Levin's social discomfort, and it revolves around something as trivial as fingernails.
Well, the fingernails. Levin goes to Moscow to visit his brother-in-law, Steva, at his government office. Steva introduces Levin to a fellow bureaucrat named Grinevich.
And Levin becomes instantly, intensely fixated on Grinevich's hands.
He cannot stop staring at Grinevich's extremely long, manicured, yellow, filbert-shaped fingernails.
For a listener today, long fingernails might just seem like a stylistic choice.
Sure. But to Levin, who spends his days inspecting plows and dealing with soil, human hands are tools. If you work, you cut your nails short so you don't break them.
Levin looks at Grinevich and realizes this man has intentionally cultivated massive fingernails and accessorized them with huge, shining cuff studs, specifically to guarantee that his hands are utterly useless for physical labor.
Levin experiences a visceral hatred looking at those hands.
Tolstoy uses this microscopic detail to explain a massive macroeconomic philosophy. Those fingernails symbolize everything Levin despises about urban intellectuals and bureaucrats.
They represent a class of people whose entire existence is decorative.
In Levin's rural world, value is strictly tangible. It's measured in bushels of wheat, the health of the cattle, the repair of a barn.
But in Grinevich's world, value is entirely abstract. It's generated by moving papers across a desk with long, white, useless fingers, feeding parasitically off the labor of the peasants.
This abstract obsession extends to what the intellectuals in the city actually talk about, too. Levin sits in these drawing rooms, listening to his half-brother, Sergei, debate the Slavonic question.
For context, this was a massive geopolitical debate at the time regarding Russia's obligation to defend Orthodox Slavs in the Balkans against the Ottoman Empire.
It was the trending topic of the decade. Everyone in high society had an opinion on it.
But Levin finds the entire conversation absurd. These intellectuals spend hours passionately debating the fate of foreign nations while remaining completely ignorant of the starving peasants on their own estates.
They expend massive amounts of intellectual energy on theoretical politics, but they never actually do anything. They don't plant, they don't harvest, they just talk.
Levin's rejection of the Slavonic question is his rejection of hollow performative empathy.
Exactly.
So, keeping these massive philosophical divides in mind, let's narrow our focus for you listeners. When you engage with the Clara Nourricio audiobook, the sheer volume of hours can make it easy to miss the architectural pillars holding the story together.
We want to highlight key scenes and motifs that act as load-bearing walls for the narrative.
You have to listen for these moments because they explain the mechanics of the tragedy. Let's start with the most famous symbol in the book, the motif of the train.
Tolstoy brilliantly weaponizes the train as the ultimate symbol of modernity, of fate, and of an unstoppable, crushing iron force.
The train isn't just transportation. It's a mechanism of destruction.
Its first major appearance occurs when Anna and Vronsky meet for the very first time at a railway station. They lock eyes, there is an immediate spark, but that romantic inception is instantly, violently interrupted.
A railway watchman falls onto the tracks and is crushed to death by a backing train.
It is a horrific, visceral moment amidst the polite chatter of the aristocrats.
Anna is deeply shaken, and she immediately, instinctively calls it an omen of evil. It establishes from chapter one that the force drawing her to Vronsky is fundamentally linked to the force of a locomotive tearing through human flesh.
That omen echoes continuously. Later, after Anna has successfully repaired her brother's marriage, she boards a train to return to her safe, predictable life in Petersburg.
And the chapter detailing this overnight journey is a masterclass in psychological unraveling. The audio performance of this section is particularly vital.
She is sitting in the carriage reading a standard English novel, trying to distract herself, but she is vibrating with this bizarre, terrifying new energy.
She experiences a complete sensory breakdown. The boundaries of her physical reality start slipping. She feels the smooth paper knife in her hands. She registers the suffocating heat of the stove, followed by the freezing draft from the window.
She reads about a hero in her book, and suddenly feels an intense, shameful desire to be doing what he is doing.
She hallucinates that the stove heater in the carriage is gnawing on the wall. She hears the screech of the metal wheels and interprets it as a fearful shrieking, like someone being torn into pieces.
Tolstoy is mapping the exact moment her internal architecture collapses. She's being literally and metaphorically derailed.
The iron tracks that dictated the direction of her life as a respectable wife and mother had been permanently warped by her encounter with Vronsky.
The train is no longer carrying her home. It's carrying her toward her doom. This delirium foreshadows her tragic return to the railway station at the end of the novel.
The train is the inescapable, brutal force of her own passion and the unforgiving machine of her society.
Moving from the brutal noise of the train, let's focus on a moment of devastating, quiet visual power. The scene of the black velvet gown.
Oh, this occurs at a grand ball in Moscow early in the novel. Kitty goes to this ball fully expecting Vronsky to propose.
She has painstakingly chosen her outfit, a complex, youthful pink and white tulle dress, and she specifically hopes that Anna will wear lilac.
Because lilac would signify a kind of safe, maternal softness.
But Anna arrives in a low-cut gown of black velvet.
The visual contrast Tolstoy constructs here is lethal. Kitty is dressed to represent innocent, hopeful youth. Anna, however, appears framed by this severe, absorbing darkness, showcasing her sculpted ivory shoulders with a delicate wreath of pansies in her dark hair.
Kitty looks at Anna, and the realization hits her like a physical blow. The narrator describes Kitty seeing Anna's deliberate grace.
She notices the quivering, flashing light in Anna's eyes and the subtle, triumphant smile curving her red lips.
Anna is intoxicated by the immediate, visible adoration radiating from Vronsky. He is looking at her as if he wants to fall to his knees in total submission.
The mechanics of this scene are critical to understand. Anna hasn't come to the ball scheming to steal Vronsky.
No, she isn't acting maliciously toward Kitty. The attraction operates like a massive gravitational pull.
The black velvet acts as a frame for a woman who is suddenly, fiercely awakened to her own devastating vitality.
That sheer force of awakened life renders Kitty's sweet pink tulle completely invisible to Vronsky. It is the physics of attraction overcoming the polite rules of courtship.
It is entirely brutal to witness. And that brutality scales up in another incredibly famous set piece, the horse race.
Vronsky is participating in an officer's steeplechase. He is riding his beloved English mare, Frou Frou. It is a highly dangerous track filled with massive obstacles.
But the genius of Tolstoy is that the true danger in this scene isn't located on the muddy track.
No, the actual hazard is located in the grandstands.
Because Karenin, the husband, is sitting in the pavilion. But he isn't watching the horses.
He is a man who reads human behavior the way he reads a tax report, and his eyes are locked exclusively on his wife's face.
As the race progresses, the tension mounts. Finally, Vronsky makes a fatal error and breaks Frou Frou's back.
Which is a heavy-handed but effective metaphor for what he will eventually do to Anna.
When Vronsky's horse falls, a collective shudder goes through the crowd. But Karenin observes that Anna is completely oblivious to the other riders falling. Her gaze is laser-focused on Vronsky.
And when Vronsky goes down, Anna loses all control over her physical reactions.
Her unmasked terror provides Karenin with absolute, undeniable proof. She pales, she gasps for air, she struggles to maintain her composure.
Karenin, watching with his cold, dull eyes, registers this breakdown of decorum. This is the precise moment the private secret breaches the hull and becomes a public reality.
Karenin doesn't care that she loves another man. He cares that she is displaying that love where other bureaucrats can see it.
Which culminates in the final key structural scene we need to map out the theater incident. This is the moment the hammer officially falls on Anna's life.
Let's set the stage. Anna and Vronsky have returned to Petersburg from their exile in Italy. They are living in a hotel, existing in a state of suffocating limbo.
Anna is isolated, legally barred from her son, and entirely cut off from the society she used to rule.
In an act of desperate, almost suicidal defiance, she decides she is going to attend the opera to hear a famous singer, Patti.
She dresses in a spectacular low-necked gown, dripping in lace, and insists on taking a box at the theater.
Vronsky pleads with her to stay home. He understands the mechanics of their society perfectly.
He knows that his peers will tolerate his presence. The patriarchal rules grant him immunity, but they will absolutely annihilate her if she dares to present herself openly as an unrepentant, fallen woman.
She refuses to hide. She goes to the theater, sits in her brightly lit box, radiating a defiant, tragic beauty, and in the adjacent box sits Madame Kardasova, a pillar of high society.
Madame Kardasova doesn't just ignore Anna. She executes the cut, which is the most violent social weapon available in the 19th century.
The cut is a deliberate, highly visible refusal to acknowledge someone's existence.
Madame Kardasova turns her back entirely, throws on her mantle, and begins speaking loudly and furiously about the absolute disgrace of sitting next to such a woman.
She forces her husband to physically flee the box, deliberately avoiding any bow or acknowledgement of Anna.
To an outsider, you just see a beautiful woman sitting quietly at an opera. But Tolstoy exposes the internal mechanism of the violence.
The text states she was undergoing the sensations of a person trapped in the stocks being publicly flogged.
This is the execution. The door of society is slammed permanently in her face.
And the true tragedy is how she processes this trauma. She doesn't direct her fury at the hypocritical society that condemned her. She directs it entirely at Vronsky.
She turns to him and says, "You are to blame for everything."
It is the breaking point. The isolation is complete, and she turns her pain inward and onto the only person left in her world.
I want to transition here to the medium itself, because consuming this novel through the Clara Horatio audiobook fundamentally alters how a listener absorbs these moments of psychological violence.
When you look at the printed page, your eyes can easily glaze over dense, page-long paragraphs of a character's internal thoughts. You miss the speed. You miss the panic.
That is because Tolstoy was effectively pioneering the stream of consciousness technique decades before James Joyce or Virginia Woolf formalized it.
He was attempting to replicate the chaotic, nonlinear, associative way the human brain actually processes trauma in real time.
The audiobook format traps you inside that real-time processing. You don't just read about their anxiety. You are forced to listen to the frantic, shifting, erratic pacing of their minds.
The ultimate execution of this technique is Anna's final carriage ride through the streets of Moscow. She has just engaged in a vicious foundational argument with Vronsky.
She is drowning in jealousy, convinced he loves another woman.
She throws herself into a hired carriage, and as the wheels clatter over the cobblestones, her mind accelerates into a vortex of total despair.
And how does Tolstoy illustrate this despair? He doesn't just have her think about her sadness. He violently fuses her internal agony with the random, mundane, external sights passing by her window.
It is an acoustic nightmare in the best possible way. The audiobook narrator speeds up, matching her spiraling panic.
She is agonizing over Vronsky's waning affection, and her eyes suddenly lock onto a mundane shop sign. Titkin coiffeur.
Her brain immediately repeats it in a mocking French phrase, je me fais coiffer par Titkin. It makes no sense, but it's exactly how an overstressed brain misfires.
She watches a fat, red-faced gentleman taking off his hat. She sees an ice cream vendor wiping his sweating face with a dirty towel, and her brain uses that image to conclude that human beings only desire what is sweet and dirty.
Every object she sees is drafted into the service of her depression. She sees a beggar woman and instantly deduces that the entire human race has been flung onto this earth for the sole purpose of torturing and hating one another.
The external world, the schoolboys, the signs, the dirt, it all becomes evidence in her mental trial against the universe.
Hearing this performed aloud turns a dense block of text into a visceral panic attack. The claustrophobia is palpable.
The audiobook also heavily emphasizes the contrasting acoustic environments of the novel. When you read, the dialogue blends together.
When you listen, you are struck by the sharp distinction between the superficial, high-pitched, French-laced chatter of the Petersburg drawing rooms and the heavy, earnest, agonizingly slow internal monologues of Levin in the fields.
The medium of sound exposes the artificiality of the city. You can literally hear the difference between performance and authentic suffering.
Which brings us to the ultimate question of relevance. Why subject ourselves to the suffering of these 19th century aristocrats? We don't live in fear of Madame Kardasobas snubbing us at the opera.
No, but the psychological architecture Tolstoy built is terrifyingly modern. The book is a masterclass in the anatomy of isolation.
It perfectly diagrams how a relationship collapses under the sheer weight of extreme dependence. Think about the physics of Anna and Vronsky's life in that hotel.
Because Anna surrendered her son, her social standing, and her reputation for Vronsky, she requires him to be the sole source of her meaning.
She demands that he surrender his entire life to her in return.
But Vronsky hasn't surrendered everything. The patriarchal rules mean he still has access to his world.
He still goes to his club. He still breeds horses. He still has political ambitions and male friendships. He retains his independence.
And that asymmetry breeds a lethal, toxic jealousy that feels incredibly contemporary. Anyone who has ever been in an intensely codependent relationship recognizes the mechanics at play here.
Anna needs constant, overwhelming proof of Vronsky's devotion to balance the ledger of her massive sacrifice. If he simply wants to go to Moscow to arrange the purchase of an estate, she interprets it as a complete withdrawal of his love.
Her dependence suffocates Vronsky, causing him to pull away to catch his breath. His withdrawal triggers Anna's abandonment trauma, causing her to cling harder.
It is a feedback loop of misery. She explicitly realizes that if he is only staying with her out of a sense of duty, without the original burning passion, they are living in a hell of their own creation.
They're trapped in an echo chamber, and all the oxygen has been consumed.
Conversely, Levin's struggles resonate with an entirely different modern anxiety, the crisis of purpose.
Levin is a man suffering a severe existential crisis regarding his career, his labor, and his impact on the world. He looks at his peers in the city, the knowledge workers of his day, and realizes they are generating nothing of substance.
Levin rejects the concept of progress as defined by the urban elite. He is terrified by the idea of living a life composed entirely of abstract intellectualizing.
His desperate attempts to reform his farming practices, to write a book on agricultural economics, to physically swing a scythe alongside his peasants, these are all attempts to anchor himself to reality.
It is the exact same anxiety that drives someone today to quit a six-figure corporate job, answering emails to open a bakery or build furniture.
Levin is asking, is what I'm doing real? Does it leave a mark?
He ultimately concludes that abstract political debates will not save him. The only thing that provides a bulwark against the meaningless void of the universe is the quiet, daily, localized connection to the land and to the family he builds with Kitty.
Which serves as the perfect framework to keep in mind as you embark on the Clara Nourish Your audiobook. The entire structure of Anna Karenina is an examination of two radically different responses to the terrifying universal realization that life might be empty.
It is a study of how humans react to the void.
Anna looks into the void and attempts to fill it with an all-consuming, explosive romantic passion. She demands that another fallible human being serve as her complete salvation.
And that demand acts as an accelerant that burns her life to the ground.
Levin looks into the same void and attempts to fill it by turning his focus outward, shrinking his world down to the immediate, tangible duties of his farm, his wife, and his faith.
But here is a final provocative thought to mull over as you listen. We often view Levin's ending as Tolstoy's prescribed cure for the human condition.
Levin finds peace in family and land, so that must be the answer, right?
Yet, just a few years after publishing this masterpiece, Tolstoy himself suffered a catastrophic psychological breakdown.
He realized that Levin's answers, family, wealth, and estate management, were completely insufficient to stave off his own terror of death.
He ended up rejecting the very art form of the novel, tried to give away all his property, and deeply alienated his own family.
It casts the entire novel in a haunting new light. When you listen to Levin's quiet triumphs at the end of the book, you might not be hearing the ultimate truth of a wise author.
You might be hearing the desperate, wishful thinking of a genius, trying to convince himself of a cure that he secretly knew wouldn't save him.
It makes the text infinitely more vulnerable.
So, as you load up the Clara Nourishio audiobook, keep your ears tuned to the friction. Listen for the shifting of patronymics that signal a changing power dynamic.
Pay attention to the manicured fingernails, the velvet gowns, and the relentless approaching rumble of the train.
By tracking these mechanics, you aren't just hearing a story about 19th century aristocrats. You are listening to a meticulous, brilliant autopsy of the human heart.
Let the full weight of Tolstoy's masterpiece wash over you.
And ask yourself, when the void opens up in your own life, what are you using to try and fill it?